And so that was the question that was being asked, and that was the conclusion that was being reached at the heart of the anti-war movement. But there was a and this is another actually a phrase from Thurborn's piece, there was a simultaneous multiplication and radicalization of the movement. So the movement grew and grew and grew, and there was a wide variety of tendencies, ranging from very sort of patriotic dissent, where America was basically good, but the war in Vietnam was a huge mistake. And that was probably, that would have been like the single largest section of the movement, obviously. And that, because, you know, more compatible with the existing ideology in American society. And that was the sentiment that fed into the campaign of Eugene McCarthy in 1968, you know, for the Democratic convention, or the Democratic nomination. But then there was a progressive growth in the anti-imperialist section of the anti-war movement. And SDS became an anti-imperialist organization. By 1968, the leadership of SDS were all communists, and most of the rank and file of SDS were revolutionary socialists of one kind or another. There'd been a huge multiplication of revolutionary organizations among young people in the oppressed communities, and they focused very, very, very heavily on the war in Vietnam because, of course, Black and Chicano and Puerto Rican and indigenous youth were the main people who were being sent to Vietnam, were the main people who were dying. And because the sort of the revolutionary kind of third world internationalism of these organizations that were developing, you know, the Black Panther Party, the Young Lords, the American Indian Movement, the Brown Berets, etc., and also especially Asian American groups, for whom the, you know, the genocidal racism that clothed everything in the Vietnam War was so, you know, so viscerally, you know, had such a visceral impact on them, because, you know, they were gooks at home, basically. So for this whole generation of, you know, youth in the oppressed communities in the United States, the connection between their oppression at home and the war in Vietnam was really, really obvious by, you know, by 1968, 69, and these organizations are growing by the thousands, and they have the ear of the majority of people in their communities, at least of the majority of young people. And it's, you know, it's not exactly the same among, you know, working class white Americans, but from 1968, there are progressively growing efforts to expand the anti-war movement into, you know, middle America. And a lot of sort of campus-based anti-war organizers started to discover that actually working people had been more opposed to the war the entire time. They hadn't really recognized it, and usually it was sort of at the level of resenting, you know, resenting the costs of the war. But, you know, this was seen as, you know, by, you know, the anti-imperialist wing of the anti-war movement as, you know, a basis on which to build towards, you know, a more developed political evaluation of the war, which I think is sound. So that's the situation by 1968, 69. And you also have, you know, at the level of like the mass anti-war movement, leaving aside sort of the ideological aspect, you have some of the largest demonstrations in American history, right? You have demonstrations of 250,000, 300,000, 500,000 people in, you know, Washington going on annually by this point. You have, you know, demonstrations of that size as well in, you know, were happening in New York or San Francisco, and you have demonstrations all over the country just spreading. You also have increasingly intense confrontations on the campuses, and you have a direct action component of the anti-war movement with student and youth activists trying to shut down induction centers, trying to drive recruiters for companies like Dow that made napalm off of their campuses. And that precipitated huge state repression, you know, campus police, regular police, etc. So there was that. There was also, of course, draft resistance, right? Hundreds of thousands of young American men either fled the country, they went to Canada, you know, tens of thousands of people came to Canada, or some people went underground in the United States to avoid the draft. There was, you know, the sort of the very dramatic and, you know, sort of heroic gesture of people burning their draft cards in public. And definitely several thousand people did that. several thousand men. So there was enough draft resistance to make it a political worry. It's not so much that they actually interfered with the operation of the draft, but it did become a huge political problem. And you also, of course, as John Pilger mentions in the documentary segment that you played at the beginning, you have the increasing sort of decomposition of the army. Because by the late 1960s, people being drafted, people going into the army, had been affected by the wider climate and by the growing opposition to the war, and because even if the response of many, many, many people to what they actually did in Vietnam was just to become more brutalized and more cynical and more racist, for at least a section of them, they were horrified. You know, they were horrified by what was going on around them. They were horrified by what they had, done themselves. And increasing numbers of soldiers came back from the war in Vietnam, absolutely, disgusted with the American military, and, significant numbers of them became anti-imperialist. And you had organizations, most famously Vietnam Veterans Against the War. You also had a group called the Movement for a Democratic Military. And there was an organization that was started by a member of the Workers' World Party who got himself sort of deliberately, obeyed the draft and went in and did anti-war organizing in the army under the pretext of trying to unionize the army. So they called themselves the American Servicemen's Union. The point was not actually to, establish a trade union for the military, but it was sort of one particular kind of form for organizing against the war within the army. And by the turn of the 1970s, the army in South Vietnam is just collapsing, right? People are murdering their officers. The phrase is drug-ridden, dispirited, we're not near mutinous. That's from, an Armed Forces journal article from 1971. But before that, the anti-war movement in the U.S. sort of peaks in 1970. So Richard Nixon runs on a platform of ending the war, because that's become the only politically tenable thing that you can say in America by the fall of 1968, was that you wanted to end the war one way or another. So Nixon says, I have this secret plan up my sleeve to end the war. And basically what he had was a series of plans that were intended to win the war for the United States, and one by one they all failed. Sort of the most dramatic of those plans was to take out, although it should be said, there was a success. Nixon had a success in that he increasingly withdrew U.S. troops from Vietnam. The policy of Vietnamization, of sort of increasingly relying on the South Vietnamese army, which helped to attack the anti-war movement at home, because, the anti-war movement sort of main appeal was that Americans didn't want, their sons and their brothers and their husbands dying in Vietnam. So if there was less and less risk of that, and young men felt that they were less at risk of being drafted, people had less reason to be turned on to the anti-war movement. So that was a very, very intelligent thing for Nixon on that level. In the long run, relying on a South Vietnamese army that didn't want to fight was obviously militarily and politically impossible. There's a huge, vast difference in morale between the two Vietnamese armies, because the revolutionary forces, the army of, socialist North Vietnam and the National Liberation Front in the South, knew that they were fighting for the liberation of their people and for peace and for unity and for independence and for socialism. And the army in South Vietnam, they could recognize that they were fighting for a clique of gangsters and for foreign invaders. So the South Vietnamese army was absolutely not reliable. So in this context, Nixon invades Cambodia in 1970. It's initially supposed to be in secret. Obviously, as you were talking about, as Michael Yates talked about that article, there was a long, long war in Cambodia that was kept secret for a long time. But then in March 1970, they announced that they're invading Cambodia in order to dislodge NLF supply lines that sort of went between North Vietnam and South Vietnam through Cambodia. And because Nixon had said that he was going to end the war, and now he was escalating it very, very visibly, people were incensed. Within hours of this announcement, there were demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of people. And then, in that context, for white students were shot dead at Kent State, and then a few days later, two black students were shot dead at Jackson State. And because this was the first time that white youth had been subjected to that kind of state repression, people were shocked. Many people pointed out they shouldn't have been shocked. And there's a special sort of, you can tell if people actually went through this experience, or at least went through this experience as a member of the radical left, because people who did will always talk about Kent State and Jackson State because of the, you know, the anti-racist commitment that was so fundamental to the politics of the time. But Kent State is the one that gets immortalized in national memory because white people were killed at Kent State. But in any case, that precipitates something really, really extraordinary. The absolute peak of the anti-war movement. Basically, the post-secondary education system in the United States is shut down. 4 million students go on strike. Hundreds of thousands of faculty go on strike. There are bombings of ROTC and, you know, military research operations on campuses across the country. People are burning buildings. The college towns are, like, it's just weeks of street fighting in the college towns. Really, really extraordinary. By that stage, 500 people are deserting from the army every single day. And there was a petition that circulated around this time in the offices of the State Department denouncing the war. Kissinger said that the fabric of the government was coming apart. And just sort of one kind of anecdotal thing for the intensity of the mobilization in the student milieu and sort of the pitch that the conflict was, that people thought was happening. There's a documentary called The War at Home that was released in the late 1970s, and it documents the anti-war movement in Madison, Wisconsin, which was one of its centers. And they talked to this activist who says that during the period of, like, the street fighting after the invasion of Cambodia and after Kent State and Jackson State, one particular night of this street fighting, he and, you know, and a comrade were out in the street, and they had guns, and they saw a police officer that they thought was about to shoot somebody, and they prepared to shoot this police officer before the cop sort of put his gun away or whatever. Like, he didn't know. He couldn't see them. But the situation was such that you had leftists out in the street thinking about, you know, opening fire on a police officer, right? That was the intensity of the confrontation that was going on. So things sort of declined from there to a large extent because, well, for a number of reasons. A lot of the organizations are being torn apart. The National Anti-War Organizing Coalitions keep splitting. SDS, which had been sort of the main organizing vector for white students and white youth, falls apart for various other reasons related to its own internal politics, its own sort of internal development in 1969. It doesn't exist anymore by the time of the great campus uprising in 1970. It's sort of an interesting kind of question what would have happened in April, May 1970 if there had still been this overarching national student organization. But tragically, there wasn't. And because of Vietnamization, fewer and fewer people out in, you know, normal America are that concerned with the war anymore. But every time Nixon sort of launched another one of his schemes to kind of finally score the knockout blow and end the war, there would be another uptick in anti-war activity. So that happened towards the end of the war, actually. When they launched, the Americans launched a series of bombing attacks on Hanoi and Haiphong in North Vietnam over Christmas, and they mined the harbors in the main cities in northern Vietnam. So that was sort of the end of 1972, the beginning of 1973. And the Paris Peace Accords were signed in 1973, January 1973, and the Americans agreed to, you know, to leave Vietnam. And the anti-war movement sort of, it peters away very, very quickly after that. The most radical, the most politically conscious sections of it tried to continue organizing because the war hadn't ended, obviously. American troops had left, but the war wasn't over. The war, of course, continues for two more years. The North Vietnamese thought that they wouldn't take Saigon until 1977. Because they overestimated, or they underestimated how decayed the South Vietnamese military was, and how totally demoralized the South Vietnamese military was. So when they finally won, they were surprised by how quickly it came. But by the time the war ended, you know, hundreds of thousands of Americans had, because of the anti-war movement, acquired a realistic understanding of U.S. imperialism, of the place of the United States in the world, of the nature of American society such that it was, you know, of what existed in American society that compelled it to commit genocide in Vietnam. And it had been a huge spur to every other political movement of that time, including, you know, movements that we haven't talked about, like women's liberation and gay liberation. Many of the people who started, you know, second wave feminism in America, gay liberation in America, and again, in other places as well, in Canada, in Western Europe, in Britain, all over the world, were first politicized opposing the U.S. war in Vietnam. And then for some, sort of the process was, you know, learning that the general, you know, anti-war movement, the general left still had all of its own problems, and so now we have to have a movement to deal with our own particular concerns. That was the experience of a lot of women who were involved in these movements and who were involved in the New Left in general and came to, you know, the realization that it was, you know, still sexist and oppressive. And so following on that, but sort of drawing on the lessons in terms of organizing and a lot of the rhetoric and the ideology and the, sort of the general kind of framework that they had picked up during the experience of the war, of the anti-war movement. So it was an immensely radicalizing experience for people all over the world. And there's still, there's still people of that generation who are, you know, who are still active in all kinds of popular progressive movements today. And many, you know, still active in, you know, in the radical side of those movements. So that's sort of the, again, what I would say is the positive impact of the polarization that happened over the war in Vietnam. Obviously, the American war against Vietnam was a horrific crime, but the fact that it enabled significant numbers of people to understand the truth about imperialism was a positive thing.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we see that in the music of that time. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I mean, and not just like from people who are like specifically like say political, like artists, this sort of thing. I mean, there's this one song which I'm about to play. This is Donovan, the Ballad of a Crystal Man. And I listened to this song when I was a kid. My parents were both heavily into this guy. You know, of course, like a folk singer at this time, like very popular. You know, I had no idea what it meant, like the political content of this song and how radical it was. And I was just listening to it actually like a few days ago, and it was just blew me away. Like how much the kind of things we've talked about like show up in songs by like, you know, these people.
Yeah.
You don't really expect to hear that kind of stuff from. But at that time, you know, this is coming out from, you know, all these different places, like all these different people are involved in some way, or they feel they have to say something about
it. Yes, it was something that, right? nobody in public life could avoid saying something.
You can't ignore it. So anyway, that's you're listening to Back in the USSR, and this is what we're going to play. This is Donovan, the Ballad of a Crystal Man, and we are talking to Brendan Campisi about the Vietnam War. So please stay tuned.
Walk along and talk along and live your lives quite freely. But leave our children with their toys of peppermint and candy. For seagull, I don't want your wings, I don't want your freedom in a lie. Your thoughts, they are of Harlequin, your speech is of Quicksilver. I read your faces like a poem, kaleidoscope of hate. Boss eagle, I don't want your wings, I don't want your freedom in a lie. On the quilted battlefield of soldiers dazzling made of toy tin, the big bomb like a child's hand could sweep them dead just so to win. Boss eagle, I don't want your wings, I don't want your freedom in a lie. As you fill your glasses with the wine of murdered Negroes, think you not of beauty that spreads like morning sun glow? Seagull, I don't want your wings, I don't want your freedom in a lie. I pray your dreams are vivid screams of children dying slowly, and as you polish up your guns, your real self be reflected. Boss eagle, I don't want your wings, I don't want your freedom in a lie. Vietnam, your latest game you're playing with your blackest queen. Damn your souls, a curse your grins, I stand here with a fading dream. Boss eagle, I don't want your wings, I don't want your freedom in a lie.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Donovan with that was a very anti-war song there. The Ballad of a Crystal Man. Now, one of the things we talked about, we have Brendan Campisi here on the show. One of the things we talked about, of course, was the radicalization among African Americans. And this is something we talked about in previous shows, actually, you've been on.
Yeah.
And one of the very inspiring, actually, tracts, political pieces which I've read about this time. This is from September 13th, 1969, in the magazine of the Black Panther Party, which is simply called the Black Panther. And this is called "To the Courageous Vietnamese People Commemorating the Death of Ho Chi Minh." You know, Ho Chi Minh, of course, being the leader of the liberation struggle in Vietnam until his death. You know, and he of course fought against the French and the Japanese, as well as ultimately against the Americans, for the liberation of his country and his people. And it goes like this. So this is written by the Black Panthers. To die for the fascist, imperialistic warmongers of the U.S. and others of the world. To die for the oppressive ruling circles of the bourgeoisie exploiters. To die for the capitalistic, aggressive, inhumane, atrocious, genocidal regimes is a death lighter than a feather, which a destructive windstorm can blow about at random will. But to die for the people, to die for the correct socialistic development of mankind, to die in the midst of socialistic revolutionary change for human survival, to die for your nation and your people's right to self-determination in their land, home, and community, to die for the freedom of all from oppression that the Black Panther Party has witnessed in the proletarian internationalism practiced by the Vietnamese People's Revolutionary Representatives that we have met, to die after all the great heroic and dedicated years of sacrifice to bring to the world and its people an end to the murderous stormy winds of capitalism's fascist aggressive imperialism, to die because he loved the people of his nation and humans of the world, and Brother Ho Chi Minh had practiced this all the days of his life. To die for all of this is a death heavier than the highest mountain in the world, of which no, not any destructive fascist imperialistic storm can blow away at will. Who can find the feather or feathers that were blown away by the destructive windstorm? I can't find any. Who can see the mountains since the windstorm is gone? I can see many, and they still stand. There, that mountain will always stand, and Ho Chi Minh is that mountain, a death heavier than Mount Tai. Right? So these are black Americans, and they're writing in solidarity with, the Vietnamese, like people fighting for the liberation of their country at that time in 1969, which really is, almost at the height of the war right there.
Yeah.
You know? So, and we talked about, just during the song there, about some of the intensity of some of the actions, the people of color where they were actually, confronting, just the most atrocious police violence at this time.
Yeah.
Like their organizations, basically they were fighting almost for survival, really. In addition, fighting, against the war.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So the example that came to mind, specifically as it relates to the anti-war movement, of course, the political mobilization of, people of color in the United States at this time was ranged far beyond, the anti-war movement and the state repression that was directed against organizations like the Black Panther Party extended to absolutely every aspect of their activity. But it's not an accident that the United States government felt particularly threatened by organizations that were, declaring open solidarity with its enemies, and that were, again, gaining the ear of a significant section of people to the perspective that actually America's enemies are not, are not your enemies, right? And one of the most incredible examples both of that mobilization and of the repression was a demonstration that took place in Los Angeles on August 29, 1970. And it was the largest demonstration against the war to be organized by any one particular oppressed community. And it was a demonstration basically by the Chicano people of Los Angeles against Chicano people who were from across the Southwest who were mobilized for this demonstration. But it was a Chicano demonstration against the war. That was what the nature of the event was. And the messaging, the slogans of this event were, our war is here at home.
Mm-hmm.
We won't fight the Vietnamese for American imperialism and American oppression. Yes to La Raza, no to the war. And the response was absolutely brutal repression from the police. There were two or three demonstrators who were killed. Although it wasn't it wasn't one sided. The demonstration happened, and then the police attacked, and then people resisted, and it developed into a major confrontation in the streets of East Los Angeles that went on for, for hours after this demonstration. So it was a brutal attack, definitely, but it wasn't, one-sided. There was resistance to this from, the people who'd come out for this demonstration and the people in the community in general. And sort of the most egregious aspect of this repression was that the Los Angeles police took the opportunity during this demonstration to murder a Chicano journalist named Ruben Salazar, who was not taking part in the demonstration at all. He was sitting in a bar near the demonstration. I think he'd been covering it, and he'd gone off to have a drink. And they fired a tear gas canister at him while he was sitting at this bar and killed him. So that's I think that's sort of a particularly dramatic example of the kind of political struggle and the kind of intense repression that went on around the issue of war in Vietnam during this period.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, this is very, severe repression. And we talked about the Black Panther Party and the kind of repression it faced last time you were on the show.
Right.
Or one of the last times you were on the show. I can't remember exactly when that was. But it's one of those things I actually come back to. I listened to that episode of the show. I have done that. Just because, the way we covered, and I think this is a testament to how you did it, and you did a very amazing job, just illustrating like the extent of political repression,
right,
in American society at that time. I mean, it was massive, and really, it's I mean, we see like what an imperialist state that does face this kind of internal crisis, how it responds.
Yeah.
Right. And it's, you know, especially when you have like this level of racism and these kind of like internal, you know, internal contradictions that the United States has and really has always had. And probably will always continue to have until like basically you have a revolutionary change in that society. Right.
Yeah.
So, well, we're at about 10:30 now. So I think, just to give our voices a bit of a rest, I think we'll sign off with this interview here and move on. But thank you very much, Brandon, for being on.
Thanks for having me. Great opportunity.
Yep. And like this is, once again, a very timely thing. We need to cut through the mythology surrounding this, just because, of course, history revision, you know, the revision of history, the distortion of history by these forces that the powers that be that do control the ruling class, you know, the ruling class in society, that allows stuff like this to happen again. You know, this kind of imperialistic wholesale destruction of entire countries. And in fact, like one of the things that definitely angers me perhaps the most is like the level of destruction which has happened in places like Syria and Libya and places like that. And like, where do you see the people? Where do you see anybody caring?
Yeah. You see
what the U.S. empire is doing here.
The same process being repeated again and again in our, you know, in our own lifetime. But, you know, I think this is sort of like the $1 million question for anti-imperialists, the $1 million question for the left today. It should be, is why do we not see the kind of response? And what are the factors that, you know, not just to lament it, but and you know, I can't offer an explanation for this right now, but that's something that, you know, we all need to think long and hard about. Is it what are the factors that created this mass opposition during the period of the war in Vietnam that are not operating today or not being properly worked on today? Mm-hmm. Sort of what, and you know, what is it that we can do? You know, it's important not to romanticize. And obviously it was very, very difficult and a lot of work and a lot of political struggle to create that movement. And that movement had its own limits. It had its own, you know, deficits and its impact was limited, although very, very real. There's evidence that Nixon would have used nuclear weapons if the anti-war movement hadn't existed. And the one thing I should have said about Cambodia is, and the explosion around Cambodia is that 30 days after the announcement that they were invading Cambodia, they had to leave. They had to get out. So that was a concrete success. So notwithstanding, you know, problems and limits that that this movement had, I think it's, it's an absolutely crucial task to sort of to reflect on that in a way that's, you know, that's geared toward creating an anti-imperialist, anti-war movement with teeth today.
Yeah, and of course, like, solidarity is a major aspect of this, like building solidarity with the peoples who are resisting imperialism.
Right.
And, I mean, that's something we didn't even touch on. I mean, we could come back and do a whole other show on that. Like, we've mostly
been talking about Americans.
Yeah, where we'd actually talk about
the history of the
liberation struggle in Vietnam, which is a long history, you know, and an incredibly heroic history.
Absolutely.
Like, despite also being very harrowing, like, the amount of things that they faced up to and they overcame. To ultimately achieve independence and self-determination. And so that's why I actually want to end with Ewan McCall, The Ballad of Ho Chi Minh, which pays tribute to Ho Chi Minh. Of course, he was the leader of that liberation struggle for decades. And but who, of course, was definitely not alone. You know, he stood with millions upon millions of people and was a source of inspiration to them as they fought against the Japanese, the French, and ultimately the Americans for the liberation of their country. And that is that's a very inspiring thing. And hopefully we'll come back and we can talk about him. We can talk about the other people who made that struggle possible. So anyway, thank you for listening to Back in the USSR. And please stay tuned. It's the Battle of Ho Chi Minh. We're going to end on that.
the ocean. Far beyond this is a stone red. There's a man who is father of the Indo-Chinese people, and his name it is Ho Chi Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. From Viet Bac to the Saigon Delta, from the mountains and the plains below, young and old workers, peasants at the toil and fed, and farmers fight for freedom with Uncle Ho. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh was a deep sea sailor, served his time out on the seven seas. Work and hardship were part of his early education. Exploitation is ABC. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh came back from sailing, and he looked on his native land, saw the want and the hunger of the Indochinese people, pouring soldiers on every hand. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh went to the mountain, and they formed a determined band. Chinese people drive invaders from the land. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. 40 men became 100. 100,000 and Ho Chi Minh. For done temper, the army of the Indochinese people, freedom's army of Viet Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Every soldier is a farmer. Comes the evening, he grabs his hoe. Comes the morning, he slings his rifle on his shoulder. That's the army of Uncle Ho. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh. From the mountains and the jungle, from the rice lands and the plain of reeds, Chinese people.